One of the things that psychologists discovered, although not nearly enough has been made of this, is so imagine we've discovered the basic dimensions of human temperament: extroversion, positive emotion, neuroticism, negative emotion, agreeableness. So that's like, say, aggression versus cooperation, something like that, with the attendant problems on both ends. Conscientiousness, dutifulness, orderliness, industriousness, and creativity. Those are the five. All right, so let's look at neuroticism, proclivity to feel negative emotion. All the negative emotions clump together, so they have a common core. It's probably something like stop and leave, something like that, right? Because if you're threatened, you should freeze or get the hell out of there. So that's the core reaction around which all the negative emotions are built, and they all associate. Okay, we've been able to do analysis of traits and attitudes that are tightly associated with negative emotion. Self-consciousness is indistinguishable from negative emotion, which means, like, it's indistinguishable. In fact, in one of the major personality trait measures called the NEOPIR, one of the early big five personality dimensions, self-consciousness is a facet of negative emotion. That's how tight it is. It's wow. The same thing. So what it means is, and this is very germane to your point, if you're thinking about yourself, you're miserable. Those are the same thing. And so then you might say, well, how do you get out of that? And you can't get out of that by not thinking about yourself. That's just going to backfire, right? So if you're anxious and you go to a party and you think, I'm not going to think about myself, and that's all you're thinking about, like, you're dead. I used to treat my socially anxious clients, say, go to a party and do everything you can to make other people feel comfortable. So I would explain to them what I just explained to you, but I would say, that doesn't mean you can stop thinking about yourself. It means you can start only thinking about what you can provide to other people. And that was invariably an improvement on the strategy that they had been using. But this is so crucially important, you know, because we are so reciprocal as human beings that you are lost if you only serve your own whims. It doesn't work in the long run. It alienates people. It produces a life that's devoid of meaning. It makes you anxious and isolated. And it makes you self-conscious and miserable. And so it is the case, as we alluded to earlier, that perversely enough, the best possible thing that you can do for yourself, all things considered, over the longest possible run, is to work as hard as you can on behalf of what's best in other people.
Yeah, and you and I talked about this the last time, I forget, it was a couple of years ago, I think, but I was talking, or you asked me what makes a good SEAL, like mm-hmm. what makes a good mm-hmm. SEAL, mm-hmm. and I said, well, it doesn't matter, look, you got to be a good shot, of course. You yep. got to be in good physical condition. All those things are important. You got to have the skill set. But far and away, what makes a good SEAL is someone that puts the team before themselves. Mm. That's it. That's the thing. And if you're the best shot, you're the fastest, you're the strongest, but you have yourself above the team, I don't want you in my platoon. Mm-hmm. And no one wants you in the platoon. Mm-hmm. That's the way it works. So it's interesting that psychologically, mm. if you're focused on yourself, it's going to cause problems. Either the problem of egocentric arrogance
yeah.
or the problem of, like, paranoia, or what's, yeah. what'd you just use to describe it? I mean, yeah. when someone's just focused
self-consciousness.
On self-consciousness.
Self-consciousness.
Yeah. That's the thing when I see people that are self-conscious, I was like, hey, you know who notices that you have a zit on your yeah. cheek right now? You. No yeah. one else cares.
Yeah.
No one else cares. No one's... It doesn't matter. When you walk into a room and you feel like you don't have the experience to be in a leadership position, the person that's thinking that is you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter. Now, if you go in and try and overcompensate yeah, by, yeah, for that yeah, by yeah. saying, listen, I just graduated from college and I really know how to execute this stuff, you're going to get crushed.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to make up for the fact that you actually don't know what you're doing. And everyone knows you don't. You just got here. So we know you don't know what you're doing, but we don't really care about it, so we don't see it as
negative.
No,
we just care if you think yeah. you know what you're doing yeah. more than you actually know.
Then it's a problem.
Yeah, then that's definitely a problem.
You have your reasons for being resentful, deceitful, and arrogant. You face, or will face, terrible, chaotic forces, and you will sometimes be outmatched. Anxiety, doubt, shame, pain, and illness, the agony of conscience, the soul-shattering pit of grief, dashed dreams and disappointment, the reality of betrayal, subjection to the tyranny of social being, and the ignominy of aging unto death. How could you not degenerate and rage and sin and come to hate even hope itself? I want you to know how you might resist that decline, that degeneration into evil. To do so, to understand your own personality and its temptation by darkness, you need to know what you are up against. You need to understand your motivations for evil. And the triad of resentment, deceit, and arrogance is as good a decomposition of what constitutes evil as I have been able to formulate. Is it possible to understand the world in a manner that provides protection against the temptation to traverse that lowest of roads? It is an axiom of human wisdom that clearer formulation and deeper comprehension of a problem is salutary. We will begin just that attempt with a conceptual shift, one that is difficult and perplexing for the committed materialists we moderns are. First, a question. What is the world made of? To answer this, we will need to consider reality, the world, as it is fully experienced by someone alive and awake, with all the richness of subjective being left intact, dreams, sensory experiences, feelings, drives, and fantasies. This is the world that manifests itself to, or better, that you meet head-on with your unique individual consciousness. Consider the act of awakening in the morning. If you were asked what you perceive at that moment, you might well mention the same concrete objects that anyone else might see if they woke up in bed beside you. You might describe all that you have gathered around you in your bedroom, the desk, the chairs, the clothes, messy or neatly arrayed, depending on your temperament and preference and perhaps your condition last night. You are likely to answer in this very objective, realistic manner, claiming, essentially, to see the furniture of the stage. There is, of course, some truth to your answer, although you may pay less attention to the familiar things around you than you think. Why waste time and energy perceiving what you can simply remember? However, the furniture and other contents of your bedroom are not truly what you perceive when you first wake up. You are already familiar with the place where you sleep and what it contains. There is no reason to continue to effortfully and consciously apprehend what you already understand. Instead, you are liable to perceive your surroundings psychologically. You begin to consider how you are going to conduct yourself on the stage you will inevitably occupy and what is going to happen in consequence. What you see upon waking is an array of possibilities, many of them concerning the day at hand, and others associated with the weeks, months, and years to come. What you are truly concerned with upon waking is the answer to a question. What shall I make of the possibilities that I see in play in front of me? Complex, worrisome, exciting, dull, restricted, unlimited, fortunate, or catastrophic as they may be. Out there in the potential is everything you could have. It is the realm of unrealized possibility, and no one knows its full extent. There appears to be no limit, in principle, to what can be made from what has not yet manifested itself. Everything that might yet be makes its home there. You could well consider what remains to be encountered as an eternal treasure house, a horn of plenty, which are, in fact, two of its representations. But that is only half the story, and there is the rub. If the potential you confront manifests improperly, because of a mistake on your part, because of the sheer arbitrariness of the world, then you can find yourself in terrible trouble. Out there, in the unknown, in the future, which is what you truly contend with when your consciousness reawakens, awaits everything good, but also everything terrible, painful, hellish, and deadly. Whatever potential might be, therefore, it does not follow the simple rules of material logic. Objects that play by the rules of the game we consider real, when we assume that what is real is also logical, can only be one thing at a time, and certainly not themselves and their opposite, simultaneously. Potential, however, is not like that. It is not categorizable in that manner. It is tragedy, comedy, good and evil, and everything in between at the same time. It is also not tangible, in the sense that the things we consider must be tangible. It does not even exist, except as what could be exists. Perhaps it is best considered as the structure of reality, before reality manifests itself concretely in the present, where reality appears to most self-evidently exist. But creatures such as us do not contend with the present. It may therefore be that it is not the present that is most real, at least as far as our consciousness is concerned. We have to fight to be here now, the advice of the sages. Left to our own devices, we turn our minds instead to investigating the future. What could be? Attempting to answer that question, that is life. That is the true encounter with reality. What is? That is the dead past, already accomplished. What could be? That is the emergence of new being, new adventure, brought about by the conjunction of living consciousness with the great expanse of paradoxical possibility. And if it is possibility that is most real, rather than actuality, as evidenced by the fact that it is possibility we are destined to contend with, then it is the investigation into possibility that is the most important of all investigations. But how do we investigate something that is not here, or there, or anywhere? How do we examine what has not yet manifested itself? Explore what only could be, but is not yet. And how can we possibly communicate with each other intelligibly about that attempt, trade information about the most effective conceptualizations, approaches, and strategies? The answer to that, as far as I can tell, is by communicating through stories about what is and equally what could be. And what that implies is that if possibility is the ultimate element of reality with which we contend, then it is stories that hold the wisdom that we most need to know. We naturally think of our lives as stories and communicate about our experience in that same manner. We tell people automatically where we are to set the stage and where we are going so that we can create the present out of the possibility that springs forth as we journey toward our destination. No one finds such an account out of the ordinary, but we are doing more than portraying our lives and those of others as a sequence of events. It is something deeper than that. When you depict a person's actions in the world, you describe how they perceive, evaluate, think, and act. And when you do so, a story unfolds. And the better you are at such descriptions, the more story-like your accounts are. Furthermore, we experience the world as populated by figures that represent exactly what we must contend with. The unknown, unexpected, and novel, the world of possibility, is represented in dramatic form, as is the world that we expect and strive to bring into being and ourselves, as actors faced with the unknown and the predictable alike. We use the story to represent all of this. Could it be that we communicate in stories and everyone else understands them because what everyone is doing in the world is fundamentally a story? Could that mean that the world of experience is, in truth, indistinguishable from a story, that it cannot be represented in a manner more accurate than that of the story? We are, in principle, adapted to the world, adapted to its realities. Thus, if we naturally construe the world as a story, then perhaps the world is most accurately, or at least most practically, construed as a story, and accurate and practical are not so easy to distinguish. You might argue, contrarily, that the scientific view of the world is more accurate in some sense, and that the scientific view is not fundamentally a story. But as far as I can tell, it is still nested inside a story. One that goes something like, careful and unbiased pursuit of the truth will make the world a better place for all people, reducing suffering, extending life, and producing wealth. Why practice science otherwise? Why would anyone take on the difficulties and rigors of scientific training without that motivation? There are more effective ways of making money, for example, if you have the intelligence and discipline to become a genuine researcher. And in terms of intrinsic motivation, the love of science is not precisely disinterested learning. The great experimenters and scientific writers I have known are passionate about their pursuit. Something emotional drives them. They hope that their learning, disinterested though it may be, as at present it has no specific aim except that of learning, will have some genuinely positive outcome, making the world a better place. That provides the entire pursuit with a narrative element, the motive that accompanies any good plot, and the transformation of character that makes up the best of stories. We conceptualize what we experience as a story. That story is, roughly speaking, the description of the place we are at right now, as well as the place that we are going to, the strategies and adventures that we implement and experience along the way, and our downfalls and reconstitutions during that journey. You perceive and act inside a structure like that all the time, because you are always somewhere, going somewhere else, and you are always evaluating where you are and what is going on in relation to your goal. Part of this thinking in stories is our tendency to see the world as a selection of personalities rather than as objects, situations, or events. We think about the landscape and the objects in it as furniture, but we think about the actors in our lives as personalities. And we think about ourselves in that manner too. What does that imply about how we should act and what we should believe?